that is one kind of opposition that God's people can expect. Those are three things I've mentioned that a missionary can expect in his work on the field. The first is small beginnings. The second is conversions of different types. And the third is opposition to the message. On page 40, our next principle is, in your study of Acts 15 to 18, emphasize the characteristics of an ideal missionary, which are illustrated by the life of the Apostle Paul on his second missionary journey. Acts 15:36-18:21. Let's discuss several characteristics of an ideal missionary, which are illustrated by the life of Paul on his second missionary journey. I want to mention three of these characteristics of an ideal missionary. The first characteristic of Paul as an ideal missionary is that Paul was all things to all men. Right at the beginning of this section, you have a great illustration of that. Paul was all things to all men. In other words, Paul was rightly flexible. Do you realize that flexibility is an important characteristic of every true missionary? And flexibility is an important characteristic of every true Christian. Now, only God can give us the balance there and enable us to be flexible without compromising. A great many who try to be flexible compromise. No, we're not to compromise, but we're to be flexible. And you know, when you deal with the person, you can tell pretty soon by his general way of doing things whether he has flexibility. Well, the Apostle Paul had a great deal of flexibility. In 1 Corinthians 9:22, Paul said, I am become all things to all men, that I may by all means save some. Our version says, win some. The Greek word there is the regular word sozo, which means to save. 1 Corinthians 9:22, I am become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. A very good illustration of the fact that Paul was all things to all men is in Acts 16, verse 3. Acts 16, 3 says that Timothy, Paul would have to go forth with him on his second journey, and he took and circumcised Timothy because of the Jews, their most particular parts, for they all knew that his father was a Greek. Since 1 Corinthians 9:22, all things to all men, is one of the golden texts today of compromise evangelism. It's very important for us to realize what's the difference between the way in which the Apostle Paul applied 1 Corinthians 9:22, all things to all men, and the way in which compromise evangelism applies the principle, all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. And I think the clear difference is that when the Apostle Paul applied this principle, all things to all men, he didn't contradict any objective standards of God. We are to be all things to all men, but in doing it, we're not to contradict any objective standards of God. But when those in compromise evangelism become all things to all men, that they might by all means save some, they violate objective principles of God. For example, when Paul circumcised Timothy, he didn't violate any objective standard of God. It is wrong to be circumcised, and it is wrong to be uncircumcised. There was no objective principle of God that was involved. Paul summarizes that very well in 1 Corinthians 7:19. In 1 Corinthians 7:19, he says, circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing, but the keeping of the commandments of God. So you see, he didn't violate any objective standards of God when he had Timothy circumcised. Because circumcision or uncircumcision is not wrong in itself. But when compromise evangelism applies 1 Corinthians 9:22, all things to all men, it violates objective standards of God. For example, many today wear long hair on the basis of being all things to all men. Never ask yourself this question. If the Apostle Paul were living today, would he wear long hair in order to win people to Christ, to be all things to all men, that he might be all means save some? And I think the very clear answer is given by Paul himself in 1 Corinthians 11:14-15. Listen to 1 Corinthians 11:14-15. Paul says, "Doth not even nature itself teach you that if a man have long hair, it is a dishonor to him? But if a woman have long hair, it is a glory to her." Now notice what 1 Corinthians 11:14 does not say. 1 Corinthians 11:14 does not say, "Does not our culture teach you that if a man have long hair, it's a dishonor to him?" It doesn't say that. Many today would make that a matter of culture. And they say in some cultures it would be all right, in other cultures it would not be all right. Paul doesn't say, "Does not our culture teach you?" He says, "Does not even nature itself teach you that if a man have long hair, it is a dishonor to him?" Or of course, some would ask the question, "How long is long?" You say man shouldn't have long hair, but how long is long? I think the clear-cut answer to that is long enough to distinguish a man very clearly from a woman. I mean, that much is absolutely clear. That a man's hair should be cut enough so that he doesn't look like a woman. Oftentimes, my wife and I are riding along in the automobile. She'll say something about the car in front of us, and she'll talk about the woman driving the car. I'll say, "I think it's a man." It's sometimes said, I read an article the other day, in fact, that said that teenagers these days come in three styles, in three genders, masculine, feminine, and gay. And that's about what it is. Well, now that is clearly unscriptural. If a man doesn't wear his hair in such a way that he clearly does not resemble a woman, and that is a violation of an objective principle of God. And I want to remind you again, this isn't a matter of color. This is a matter of nature. Does not even nature itself tell you? So if Paul were living today, I'm 100% sure of the fact that he wouldn't wear long hair. Because that's exactly what he says in 1 Corinthians 11:14-15. A few days ago, I saw a picture of a leading evangelist. The evangelist was wearing his hair in what I call PewDiePie style. A man doesn't have to wear his hair all the way down to his shoulders to have long hair and to resemble a woman, because many women, I think most women today, don't wear their hair down to their shoulders. And so somebody would say, "Well, just so a man doesn't wear his hair down to his shoulders, it's all right." I don't accept that at all, because he can wear his hair looking like a woman and not have it down to his shoulders, because most women don't wear that at all. And, he prints it up and all. I call it PewDiePie style. And this evangelist had his picture taken with a young person over at Eurofest. I don't know if you read anything about Eurofest over in Europe this past summer. Well, they had a big canoe over there, the same type of thing of Expo 72 and that kind of thing. Eurofest was there. They had at least one of those, something like that. They call it something different every year. But it's the same old type of thing. And showed this young fellow talking to the evangelist, and he had very long hair. Well, this evangelist keeps himself immaculately neat, and he had his hair fixed, not in that unkempt way of this other, but it was still PewDiePie style. He just looked like a woman, Well, I'm 100% sure the fact he's wrong. You say, "You're judging him." No, the Bible's judging him. I'm not judging him. The Bible's judging him. I'd be judging him if I were to judge his motive. And I would say, "Well, he just wants to make a hit." No, I don't think that's his motive at all. I think his clear-cut motive is he wants to be all things to all men, that he might by all means save some. That's his motive. I don't judge his motive adversely, not at all. But I know he's wrong. I don't think he's wrong. I know he's wrong. Because it's because I wanted you to realize what it means to be all things to all men. But since that verse is really the golden text for compromise evangelism today, I want you to realize what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that I am to violate any objective standard of God in order to be all things to all men. The illustration of it comes right towards the beginning of chapter 16. Right at the beginning of Paul's second missionary journey, I mentioned it, that he had Timothy circumcised. And you see, that doesn't violate any objective principle of God. Now later, Paul refused to have Titus circumcised. Because Titus was pure-blooded Gentile. And there is a different question involved altogether. But here, Timothy had a Gentile father, a Greek father, and a Jewish mother. And so, it was an entirely different type of thing, and he wasn't violating an objective standard of God in what he did. The second characteristic of an ideal missionary, which is illustrated by the life of Paul on his second journey, is that Paul despised not the day of small things. Paul despised not the day of small things. I wonder if you know which one of the prophets contains that injunction from the Lord that we are not to despise the day of small things. It's the next to the last book of the Old Testament, the book of Zechariah. And one thing that makes it easy to remember is they were not to despise the day of small things in the sense that they weren't to despise the temple of Zerubbabel, which was rebuilt after the captivity. It wasn't anything like as magnificent as Solomon's temple. Well, Solomon's temple had a lot of gold leaf on the outside. And really, when the sun shone on it, it was just dazzlingly beautiful. The least estimate I've ever read for the cost of Solomon's temple was $2.5 billion. Somewhere between two and a quarter billion and $4.5 billion. Quite a difference between the two, but it's whether you take the smaller weight, registered or weight, or the larger. But at least $2.25 billion, not million now, billion, for Solomon's temple. Zerubbabel's temple wasn't anything like as magnificent as that. And so Zechariah the prophet, when they rebuilt, just had to say, don't despise the day of small things. Zechariah 4:10, who hath despised the day of small things? Well, if anybody ever lived up to that command, Zechariah 4:10, despise not the day of small things, it was the Apostle Paul. Acts 16:13 says, and on the Sabbath day we went forth without the gate by a riverside, where we supposed there was a place of prayer. And we sat down and spake unto the women that were come together. Historians tell us that in New Testament times, if there were as many as 14 Jews in any locality, they built a synagogue. Well, you see, there wasn't any synagogue in Philippi, which shows you it was a very small group of Jews. So Paul just went out by the riverside on the Sabbath afternoon, and there he expected to find the group, and he did. But see, there weren't as many as 14 there. Because if there had been as many as 14, they would have built a synagogue. But they were just out in the open by the river. Well, you see, when the Apostle Paul goes, what does he expect? Oh, he expects a very small crowd. Very small crowd. And he goes, he gives you all he has. Oh, that every Christian would learn to do that, no matter how small the crowd may be. If he will just give it all he has, despise not the day of small things. You know, sometimes God may call a person to minister for a while to large crowds of people. And then through illness or through something else, God may set that person aside so that he doesn't minister to the large crowds anymore. He just has a few who come and he can minister to them. But oh, it's a great test. Does he despise the day of small things? Don't ever stop your church service because you don't have enough people there. You ever heard of a preacher who go to church? Well, it was such a snowy Sunday and all, we won't have the church service today. You remember that precious story of Spurgeon's conversion? He went through a snowstorm to church one Sunday morning, and he had that idea that the richest church would give him the best sermon. He started there with the snowstorm charging aside into a little primitive Methodist chapel. And at first, the laymen who were there, the preacher couldn't even make it because of the storm. The laymen thought they wouldn't have a service, but they got together and thought, no, Lord, you'll be honest. They'd go ahead and they just had the faithless dozen there that night. This man sort of stumbled through, but Spurgeon was saved that day. And he was a great Calvinistic preacher. You know, he was a five-pointer. I told you that folks I go to over in Atlanta are five-point Calvinists. They really are. They're five-point Calvinists. Right down the line. I'm four-point. You know, I don't go all the way with that. And then I don't try to decide everything by Calvinism. I try to decide it by this. And in a sense, they do too, but I don't think quite the same way as some of the rest of us believe in. But Spurgeon was a five-point Calvinist, and he was saved in a primitive Methodist chapel. And he was saved that morning when these laymen just wouldn't despise the day of small things. If anybody ever lived up to that principle, it was the Apostle Paul, and you have a great illustration of it on this second missionary journey. The third characteristic of an ideal missionary, which is illustrated by Paul's life on his second journey, is that Paul sang at midnight. Oh, I love that truth in Acts 16. Paul sang at midnight. In other words, he sang in the midst of great suffering. Many of you have heard missionaries say that it takes more ability to sing at midnight than it does to be an operatic star. And I believe that with all my heart. That means to sing at midnight as Paul and Silas sang at midnight. Now listen to Acts 16:25. Acts 16:25 says, but about midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns unto God, and the prisoners were listening to them. Now this was supernatural singing. I sometimes wonder whether or not Paul could carry a tune. I wonder whether or not Silas could carry it through. I'm not at all sure. The Bible doesn't tell you at all. If they had any training, musical training, the Bible doesn't mention. And if they could carry a tune, the Bible doesn't mention. You know, you've heard a person say, I can't carry a tune in a bucket. And I don't know whether Paul could carry a tune in a bucket or not, but I know this. He could sing at midnight. And oh, it takes far more ability to sing at midnight than it does to carry a tune. To have a trained voice, to be an operatic star. You know why the Bible mentions that little detail? The prisoners were listening to them. Suppose Paul and Silas went out on the street corner preaching. I doubt if the prisoners would have listened to them. Well, this was an unusual thing. What were they accustomed to hear when people spoke or sang when they were in the prison? Oh, it'd be all sorts of pornography. Pornographic songs, if they had any songs at all. And what they were accustomed to was groans and curses. That was what they were accustomed to hearing. Well, this was different, but I tell you, they had to open their ears for that. Somebody expressed it this way when he said, Paul's suffering were his platform upon which he stood when he preached us. And one of the main platforms upon which we're standing when we preach Christ is our suffering. Naturally, you don't want suffering. Lord, keep us away from the suffering. But the sufferings are the platform upon which we stand when we preach Christ. And such was certainly true in the case of Paul. Some Christians believe that Paul and Silas were so filled with joy that they hardly knew that they were suffering. You say you don't have absolute proof of it. No, you don't have absolute proof of the fact that Paul and Silas were so filled with joy, they hardly knew they were suffering. But this idea ties in with the testimony of some of the early Christian martyrs. Some of the early Christian martyrs were burning, they were on red-hot coals, and they actually said that when they were in red-hot coals, they felt as if they were lying on beds of roses. Because the joy of the Lord that so filled their souls just took their minds completely off their suffering. We said earlier that God doesn't root joy primarily in the emotion. He roots joy in the will. And that's true. No matter how you feel, no matter how I feel, we're to go on rejoicing. God doesn't root joy in the emotions. He roots joy in the will. That's true. But it's also true that there are many times in our lives when we need an unusual degree of emotional joy to see us through. And have you ever looked back at the past and wondered why you could really go through some of those things? You say, well, I just couldn't go through them now. I just couldn't go through them now. No, God doesn't call you to go through them now. But He gave you the joy that you needed at the time. And I think that's the precious truth, that it's a balance to the other side of the truth. The other side of the truth is that God doesn't root joy primarily in emotions. He roots joy in will. But this side of the truth is He will give us all the emotional joy that we need to take us through these very trying experiences in life. So those are three characteristics of an ideal missionary, which are illustrated by the life of Paul on the second journey. The first is that Paul was all things to all men, that he might by all means save some. The second is that Paul despised not the day of small things. And the third is that Paul sang at midnight. Oh, I want to be one of those who knows what it is to sing at midnight. Well, if I know, then I'm going to have some midnight. And if you know it, you're going to have some midnight. On page 41, our next principle is to emphasize important principles of missionary service, which are illustrated by Paul's second missionary journey. Suppose that you were speaking to a group of prospective missionaries about their future missionary service. From the account of Paul's second journey in Acts 15:36 to 18:21, what important principles for a missionary to keep in mind can you mention? Please discuss each principle in detail. I want to mention two important principles of missionary service, which are illustrated by Paul's second missionary journey. The first important principle, which is illustrated by Paul's second journey and by all of Paul's journey, is that evangelism in death is the foundation of true evangelism. Evangelism in death is the foundation of true evangelism. Now, when I use the expression evangelism in death, I'm not using it as some use it today. I'm not thinking of evangelism in numerical death. I'm thinking of evangelism in spiritual death. Often when people use the expression evangelism in death, they're talking about evangelism in numerical death. I'll comment on that a few moments from now, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about evangelism in spiritual death. I think a great illustration of that is this oft-quoted statement of John Wesley. John Wesley said, give me 100 men who hate nothing but sin and fear nobody but God, and I'll shake the world. And you see, that's evangelism in death. Evangelism in spiritual death. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this movement that is moving through the mission field today, evangelism in death. The idea of it is every Christian from any denomination ought to try to get together with all the others and then do the work of evangelism. That's evangelism in death. Some time ago, I was talking to one of my former students, and he said that the movement of evangelism in death has done great harm on his particular mission field. I was speaking of this sometime after that, and a returned missionary from India came to see me, and he said, I'm glad for what you said about the movement of evangelism in death. Because he said, as I see it, I don't believe we could have that movement at all in India. You know, there's so much modernism in India. Stanley Jones, the famous modernist, one of the most dangerous of all the modernists, is very well known in India. For years, he had to have it. I suppose he's still living. I suppose he still has that practice of spending 6 months every year in India, 6 months here in the United States and in other so-called Christian lands. But he's one of the reasons why it's so dangerous. And the missionary media said, we just couldn't have evangelism in death there. Well, now, does that mean that the movement of evangelism in death is all wrong? I don't think it is all wrong at all, but it needs to be guarded very carefully. And what's the great safeguard? The great safeguard is that the foundation for evangelism in numerical death must always be evangelism in spiritual death. And all that's what we're aiming at. Folks, more and more as I go along, less and less do I aim at numbers. I don't aim at numbers. I aim at evangelism and spiritual depth, and I believe the outworking of that will be the numbers that God wants us to have. Have you just ever said to the Lord, Lord, I don't want any more or any less than thy will? Person said, no, I don't want any less than God's will. And now what about that first part? I don't want any more. Absolutely. We don't want any bigger crowds than the Lord's will. We don't want any smaller crowds than the Lord's will. Don't glorify either one. Don't glorify the big crowd and don't glorify the small crowd. But glorify the Lord Jesus Christ himself. Paul had real evangelism in death, and it was spiritual death. Perhaps you're asking, well, how does the second missionary journey emphasize the importance of evangelism in spiritual death? And I believe the answer is that when Paul entered Europe with the gospel, how many people entered Europe with him? See, there were three, plus Paul. A band of four. Could you name the four? You see, one was the Apostle Paul himself, and the second was Silas from the Jerusalem church. They sent him with Paul to take the place of Barnabas. And then the third was Timothy. You know, they picked him up at Lystra. That was where Paul was stoned. God wonderful intervened, and that's where Timothy came in. Well, he won Timothy to the Lord because he called Timothy my son. He didn't win him to salvation, he certainly won him to the Christian life as he went along later. And then the fourth was Luke. And the reason you know Luke is there is that you have the first of these wee sections of Acts in the 16th chapter. You know, there's several of these wee sections. A good part of Acts is told in the third person. They, or he, but several big sections of Acts are in the first person plural. We did it, and you have that one of the first of these comes in the 16th chapter. Now, we don't know all about how Paul, how Luke was one to the Lord. F.B. Meyer has this general idea that when Paul was in Philippi, where Luke joined them, you know, the wee section begins at Philippi. Luke was living there as a physician, a doctor. And Paul was sick and called on Luke. And when Luke was ministering to him, Paul wanted Luke to the Lord. Now that, of course, is only Dr. Meyer's guess. It's only his idea. But you remember in Colossians 4, Paul refers to Luke as the beloved physician. And some Greek scholars think that the word the beloved physician there is what they call the possessive use of the article. And it ought to be translated, Luke, my beloved physician. That's the way Dr. Richie Robertson, I think, translates it that way, and other Greek scholars translate it like that. But here's your wee section, see, and you've got these four that are entering Europe with the gospel. Well, I just love the contrast that is often made between this army of four, what an army, onward Christian soldiers, marching at the war, army of just four, and another army that 500 years before that had crossed the Hellespont. You know, the Hellespont, the strait that separates Asia from Europe. Here he was at Troas, and he had the Macedonian call, that's in Asia. And they'd go over into Macedonia and help us. And they'd go across the Hellespont. 500 years before that, do you know who had crossed the Hellespont and how many had? Xerxes. X-E-R-X-E-S. Xerxes. And he had a fleet. How many, do you know? Several million. Several million. And you remember he attacked Europe, he attacked Greece by land and by sea. several millions, but he didn't conquer. And then here's an army of four that conquered. The army of four, that was what that big old army of Xerxes was always incapable of doing. And God just loved real evangelism in them. And you cannot prove that these were evangelists in death, because you don't need any more proof about the Apostle Paul, the greatest Christian by far that ever lived. I think I'm accurate in that. That's not exaggerated. Paul by far the greatest Christian we ever lived, by far. And then you just take a concordance and look up the name Timothy, trace it through, look up the name Silas, look up the name Luke, trace it through, and you see all of them were men of spiritual death. So that's the first important principle of missionary service, which is illustrated by Paul's second journey. That is that evangelism in death is the foundation of true evangelism. Not evangelism in numerical death, although maybe God's will at times to have that. That's quite all right to have it if it's the outworking of spiritual death, but all the dangers of trying to get numbers in order to multiply the witness of the Lord. The second important principle of missionary service, which is illustrated by Paul's second journey, is that the whole family is the unit at which the missionary should aim. The whole family is the unit at which the missionary should aim. Listen to Acts 16:15. Acts 16:15 says that when Lydia was baptized and her household, she besought us, saying, if ye have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come into my house and abide there, and she constrained me. There you see is the conversion of Lydia's whole household, not just Lydia, but Lydia's household. And then listen also to Acts 16:33 and 34. Acts 16:33 and 34 says, and the Philippian jailer took them the same hour of the night and washed their stripes, and was baptized, he and all his, immediately. And he brought them up into his house and set food before them and rejoiced greatly with all his house, having believed in God. So this is your principle. The whole family is the unit which the missionary should aim. Not just getting one person saved out of the family, but he should aim at the whole family. Now, that doesn't mean he's always going to get it. And I want to give you scriptures there later. And in our next period, I'm going to discuss with you that whole idea of household salvation and household covenant. There's one person specially asked me to discuss that, Acts 16:31, and I know he's not here tonight. Sorry. But I do want to discuss that with you. Believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, and thou shalt be saved, thou and thy house. And you've heard people say, well, I'm claiming that verse for the salvation of my loved one. The question naturally arises, is that a good verse to claim? Well, more of that in a moment. Now, 25 after. And we want to allow just a little extra time for in between tonight. Mr. Shepherd, would you make the announcement about that, please?
Many of you know that this is Phil's birthday today. So we'd like to say happy birthday to her. And then, you know, really quickly, there's a